So we begin the discussion of Avalokiteshvara and the Zen understanding of compassion. In the Zen tradition, there's actually not so much talk in the classic texts about compassion. A lot about wisdom and emptiness and dropping off body and mind. And like if, for example, in the koan stories, all these koan collections, really looking through those, I've been looking for various dialogues about compassion and how it functions. And in those hundreds of stories, and you could say they're all about compassion, really, but specifically about the bodhisattva's wish to free all beings from suffering, you don't find it so much in the classic Zen texts. And I think that's just because the emphasis is on letting go of small self and opening to everything, and from that great compassion comes forth. So they don't talk about it. It's sort of a given, naturally comes forth. But this one story, this dialogue of these old Zen ancestors is, as far as I can see, maybe the main Zen story about compassion and how it functions. So look forward to investigating this with you. So first, the cast of characters, starting with Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva of great compassion. We put her image on the altar here for this sesshin, in her female form, holding a baby, the great demonstration of motherly, unconditional love and compassion. I was researching a little bit the origins of Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva, one of these archetypal bodhisattvas. So, you know, not like some historical living person, but more like the archetype of great compassion. So, she arose with the Mahayana, the great compassion vehicle, around the year zero. We first find mention of Avalokiteshvara in the Mahayana sutras. Many, many Mahayana sutras. I don't know if we started going through, maybe almost all of them mention Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva. So this morning we chanted the Heart Sutra, which is actually taught by Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva. Usually the sutras are taught by the Buddha, so I think it's kind of interesting that the main sutra that we chant in Zen is, strictly speaking, taught by Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva, kind of on behalf of Shakyamuni Buddha. There's a little introduction that we don't, in our concise form of the sutra, we don't chant the introductory setting where the Buddha is like in this samadhi and he kind of invokes Avalokiteshvara and asks her to teach this emptiness sutra, perfect wisdom. And bit of research claimed that the Sukhavati Sutra, the Pure Land Sutras, are maybe the first source mentioning Avalokiteshvara, again around the year zero when the Mahayana was starting, maybe a little bit after. Avalokiteshvara is like a kind of attendant to Amitabha Buddha, who's the one who made the vow to create this pure land to benefit all beings. And similarly, Amitabha says, for those who call on my name and wanting to be with me, they will be born in this land free from suffering. And Avalokiteshvara similarly says, those who call my name, out loud, soon I'll be knocking on their door. So this kind of like calling forth great compassion, it manifests. And apparently, scholars have researched this old Sanskrit text and found that in very early versions of these sutras, the name is Avalokiteshvara, and Shvara means sound, and Avalokita means to like gaze down upon, look down. So looking down at sound, but we maybe could interpret this as regarding the sounds and cries of the world, but literally like regarding, looking, gazing at the sounds. And then there's just a few records where that's his or her name, and then the name became Avalokiteshvara instead of Avalokiteshvara. And that Ishvara means like sovereign or lord. So completely unrelated to Shvara, that means sound. So that's the name that stuck in Sanskrit, is Avalokiteshvara, which is like the sovereign or lord who gazes down. And so the Sanskrit sutras use that version of the name, but then the Chinese maybe had some older ones, or maybe some people say maybe they misread the Sanskrit when they were translating and picked up on the Shvara part, which means sound. So in Chinese, they translate Avalokiteshvara as Guanyin, that means regarder, sound. Guanyin is Chinese, and Kanon is the Japanese pronunciation, regarder of sound. And sometimes it's expanded. Maybe this came later to kind of expand the name to Guan Shiyin in Chinese, or Kan Zeon in Japanese. That means that Ze is like world, means world. So regarder of the world's sounds. Maybe it just expands it to all sounds throughout the world, all cries of sentient beings. It doesn't literally say, you know, cries. It's really just all sounds. So maybe sounds of laughter, as well as sounds of crying, as well as coughs and sneezes and Dharma teachings and arguments. She indiscriminately regards all these sounds with great openness. And Tibetan, the name is Chen Rezig, and that's literally Chen Rezig is eyes always looking. So a similar feeling. Doesn't involve sound though in that name. But there's this compassionate eyes observing sentient beings, is the spirit of Avalokiteshvara. Whether it's the Lord that regards all beings, or the one who regards the sounds, these are the names of Kanon. So it looks like in the early Indian sutras, she was male. He was a male bodhisattva, and still in Tibetan Buddhism, it's Avalokiteshvara is regarded as male, and China is where she had a sex change, and it's very mysterious how this happened exactly. John Blofeld has this whole book on the Bodhisattva of Compassion about all kinds of stories about Avalokiteshvara. And his theory, and I think it was from one of his Chinese Zen teachers, but I hadn't heard this otherwise. That teacher Chinese Zen teacher visited Tibet and saw Tara. You know, Tara is a very obviously female form of great compassion in Tibetan tradition. Avalokiteshvara is male, but the story is that Tara is born from a teardrop of Avalokiteshvara, a compassionate tear falling from his eye gave birth to this female Buddha, actually, Tara, who has a very similar role and function as Avalokiteshvara to radiate compassion and loving care to everyone. And that's how the Tibetans took it, because I think there's this natural sense that, well, we want compassion to have this kind of like feminine expression. It's natural. I mean, it manifests as male and female. It's beyond gender, of course. But like a mother's love for her child is such a wonderful demonstration. So the Tibetans took care of that with Tara. And the Chinese never picked up on Tara. Tara was in India, but the Chinese, Tara never made it to China for some reason. And maybe it's because around the time this whole thing was happening, the Chinese, before they even found Tara, they're like, wait a second, great compassion should have a female form. So it just morphed into Guanyin. It's sometimes actually still in China and Japan, occasionally you see with a mustache or a kind of like sort of androgynous form, actually. Often a very feminine body, but with a little mustache. It's kind of mixed. But generally, she's a female form, Guanyin, in China and Japan. Like this form on the altar looks quite lovingly motherly. So how these things happen is hard to know, because this is like many, many people over many, many centuries interacting and working with this archetype of great compassion. So I don't think any one person ever decides these things. But how wonderful, I think, that like the gender can change, the forms can change. Guanyin has these flowing white robes, and in the like this image in China and Japan, and looks different in Tibet. The standard form has four arms, and then there's this thousand armed form. So on the hand, on the back of this handout, there's a picture, put a Chinese woodblock of the I think that's a 42 arm form. Are there extra copies?
Yes.
Michael didn't. So sometimes four arms, sometimes 42 arms that each have a specific implement. There's one sutra that talks about each implement has, you know, to benefit others in particular ways and has a particular mantra that goes with that arm. I have a book that I didn't bring along that has a picture of a hand with an eye in each hand holding some implement and a mantra to go with it, to kind of like help in that way. 42, and then sometimes expanded to 1,000. Yeah. So this one doesn't have 1,000, but sometimes there's the 42 with implements, and then the other 1,000, that'd be too many implements to depict. So they're just this halo. You've probably seen the pictures, just hands just extending outward with no gap between in all directions, outward and outward, 1,000 hands with an eye in each hand. So the Tibetans and the Chinese and the Japanese all have the 1,000-armed Avalokiteshvara. And so also Kanzeon is the regarder of world sounds, literally. And then we also have the name Kanjizai Bosatsu. So that's in the Heart Sutra, when we chant in Japanese, we say Kanjizai Bosatsu is another translation, and I think really that the Jizai is translating that Ishvara, like Lord or Sovereign. It's the Chinese way of writing that, but literally, if you pull those characters out, the Jizai is like self-abiding, So you could say, my teacher likes to kind of like play with this Japanese way of translating, that I think the Japanese wouldn't really do this, but you could literally, character by character, say, the one who regards the way the self abides. I think they would maybe translate it more as like the regarder that naturally abides, or actually in this, our translation of the text here, which we'll get to at some point, they translate it as one who has complete freedom in perceiving. But literally it's like regarding the way the self abides. So the self abides not as a small little limited me, but as like great compassionate freedom. So Kanzeon and Kanjizai are the same bodhisattva. And then there's all these sutras that mention her or him. And just to bring up a few to kind of like celebrate Avalokiteshvara a little bit before we jump in to the Dogen's stories. This is the Sharangama Sutra, the heroic march sutra. Avalokiteshvara, Kanzeon, Bodhisattva, arose from her seat, bowed at the Buddha's feet, and said to the Buddha, "Blessed one, I remember when, as many eons ago as there are sand grains in the Ganges, there was a Buddha in the world named Contemplator of the World Sounds." So there's a Buddha named Kanzeon many eons ago. And I remember that. And I arouse bodhicitta, that altruistic aspiration for awakening, while with that Buddha, who taught me to enter samadhi through a process of hearing and reflecting. So Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva is saying, in many eons ago, there was a Buddha named Avalokiteshvara who taught me this samadhi of hearing and reflecting. And then she starts to describe this practice that she learned. "Initially, I entered into the flow of hearing and forgot the place of entry." So something maybe like listening so non-discriminately to sound that she just merged with sound. "I entered into the flow of hearing and forgot the place of entry." I forgot how I entered this flow of sound, because now I'm just in the flow. "Since both that place and the entry were quiet, the two attributes of motion and stillness canceled each other out and did not arise." So in this flow of listening to sound without any separation, stillness and motion, that duality was canceled out and did not arise. "After that, gradually advancing, the hearing and what was heard both disappeared. Once the hearing was ended, there was nothing to rely on, and both awareness and its objects became empty. When the emptiness of awareness was ultimately perfected, emptiness and what was being emptied also ceased to be. With arising and ceasing gone, tranquility was revealed." So, a lot could be said about that practice, but it sounds like just dropping away all dualities, going deeper, deeper into just the direct experience of what's happening. "And the perfect brightness prevailed throughout the 10 directions. And at that time, I attained two supreme states. First, above, I united with the wonderfully awakened mind of all the Buddhas in the 10 directions and realized the compassion equal to all Buddhas. Second, I united below with all sentient beings in the 6 realms and gained a kind regard for all living beings." So it goes on here more, but I thought, what a wonderful description of, sounds kind of like Avalokiteshvara's enlightenment. was she just realized this complete non-separation and non-duality, and where there was no entering it and no leaving it, there was no self and other, there was no movement or stillness. And at that time, she realized both the great wisdom and awakening of all Buddhas, and secondly, this great compassionate, kind regard for all sentient beings. So perfect wisdom and compassion. Therefore, she can teach the Heart Sutra, which is just about how there's not anything, vast emptiness, and at the same time, she manifests great care and compassion for all empty beings. That's her thing. And then one last sentence about this meditation, maybe a little summary of this, because I think we can play with these things in sesshin. We can try out some of these practices when listening to the rooster. It's long after dawn that the rooster keeps crowing, huh? and the birds and whatever other sounds happen through the day and are sitting. Avalokiteshvara says, because I do not contemplate sounds themselves, but rather the contemplator, I can enable beings throughout the 10 directions who are suffering and in distress to attain liberation by contemplating their sounds of reciting my name. So that's a lot, that sentence. But I thought this very interesting that I'm not actually contemplating the sound of the rooster. I start with that. I just listen to the sound. I regard the sound. I contemplate, what is this sound actually? But then, in this meditation, I'm not really contemplating the sound itself, but rather the contemplator. Like I turn the light back to look at who's actually contemplating the sound? Or who's actually hearing this? And then, we can't find anyone who hears. So, but yet there's the hearing. So through this contemplating the contemplator, in that meditation, I enable beings in everywhere who are suffering to attain liberation by contemplating their sounds of reciting my name. Pretty dynamic, but like when people say, Avalokiteshvara, or Namo Guanshuyin Busa, homage to Avalokiteshvara. When we say that, she hears our sound saying that, and she also regards who is that that's contemplating that sound, and in that not finding the contemplator, maybe we could say all separation between her and that crying one yearning to meet her, calling her name, that separation is collapsed, and she meets the suffering being directly. There's something about how compassion works. It's a little complex, maybe, but and actually inconceivable, but I think these sutras are describing something like this. We're all sitting together, and we can contemplate our sitting together and the little sounds that we're making together, and we turn that light backward, looking for who is it that's sitting with everybody here. We don't find anyone particular. We can't locate anybody here, and that's like our connectedness. That's our like non-separation, not finding a separate self. We are one body sitting together, one suffering being yearning for complete freedom. Maybe not totally suffering, maybe just a little bit like, what am I doing here again? I'm not completely at peace. But in this dropping off and letting go, we become one body practicing together, letting go of self and opening to compassion and freedom. So then we have just before the talk, I thought, oh wait, there's this other sutra I forgot about. I just found this another, of course, about Avalokiteshvara. This is the Dahishin Dharani that I think we're going to chant this evening. That is that Dharani is like a mantra of great compassion. Dahishin Dharani is great compassionate heart Dharani, and it's one of Avalokiteshvara's like mantras. Om Mani Padme Hum is the short version, maybe most famous mantra in the world, definitely amongst the Tibetans. But the long Zen version is this Dahishin Dharani, and there's a sutra that where this Dharani is first taught, called the Dahishin Dharani Sutra, or the Great Compassionate Heart Dharani Sutra. And Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva is again telling about how she came to be. It's a little bit different. It's a little bit maybe contradictory to this Sharangama Sutra that says, I was with this Buddha named Avalokiteshvara. But that's how it's okay, because she can take all these forms. But this sutra, she says, Blessed One, I remember also incalculable billions of eons ago, there was a Buddha that I was hanging out with then. But this Buddha's name is Thousand-Rayed King Motionless Tathagata. For the compassion and mindfulness for me and all living beings, he spoke this vast, perfect, unimpeded, great, compassionate heart Dharani, rubbed the crown of my head with his golden hand and said, Good child of Buddha, you should hold this heart mantra to give benefit and happiness to all living beings in the future. He's talking about the Dahishin Dharani. If you hold that, it will give great benefit and happiness to all living beings. At that time, I was at the first Bodhisattva stage, but right after hearing this mantra, the Dahishin Dharani, I realized this eighth Bodhisattva stage and was very happy and vowed, if I will be able to give benefit and happiness to all living beings in the future, let me have 1,000 hands and 1,000 eyes immediately. Could be the story of the origin of the 1,000 hands and eyes. Right after that vow, guess what happened? I got 1,000 hands and 1,000 eyes on my body, and 6 types of earthquakes occurred on the grounds in the 10 directions, and thousands of Buddhas in the 10 directions emitted their light to my body and lightened up, brightened unlimited worlds in the 10 directions. Since then, in uncountable Buddha realms and meetings, I repeatedly heard, accepted, and held this Dharani, and then was repeatedly pleased and joyful. Since then, I always recite, hold, and never forget this mantra. Because of holding this Dharani, I was always born naturally from a lotus in front of Buddhas. So that's one story about the 1,000 hands and eyes. And another story I heard was that this Bodhisattva's compassion, like opening to the suffering in the world, was so great that her head split apart from like the pain of suffering, and just kind of cracked open. Maybe her heart cracked open, but also her head cracked open. And an Amitabha Buddha, who is like one of her Buddhas, compassionately like put her back together, but gave her 11 heads, which is mentioned by Dogen in here. And that's the image on this, in this picture, is 11 heads. It's a common form of Avalokiteshvara. It's like 3, 3, 3, 1, and often the one on top, I think maybe that's true in that picture. The top head is Amitabha Buddha's head. So it's like kind of like she keeps Amitabha Buddha with great devotion, like as her top, not just on top of her head, but as her top head. And even in like this form on the altar, I can't see from here, but often the Japanese forms, there's a little like Buddha in her head, like a kind of hair bonnet. And that's Amitabha Buddha.
Amitabha represents
light, and like, you know, this Western pure land that's like, also Amitabha was somebody in this past eon who made this vow that I just want to find some way, my lifespan's so limited as a human, so I can only help so much in this lifetime. After I die, I want to be a Buddha that beyond birth and death, that never will go on endlessly, and I want to benefit beings that I'm making this vow that whoever calls my name Amitabha will, when they die, be born in this like land, this pure land. You know, and the pure land story is like, it's not really like Nirvana. It's not Buddhahood. This is all part of this, you know, Mahayana cosmology. These pure lands are just places where it's like a launching pad for Buddhahood. It's like the conditions are perfect for everything is supporting practice. So it's like Jikoji. Where it's just like you have a zendo and you have these great meals coming and all these beautiful birds and roosters and vegetables and sun and rooster and nature and all that is just like all we have to do is just sit here and open to Buddhahood. Everything's supporting us to practice, right? So Sheen is like creating a little pure land. And these pure lands are like designed to make like these would be all the supportive conditions for people to realize Buddhahood. So this is, you know, stories that we have. Yeah.
Kukyo in the Heart Sutra, our most commonly chanted sutra, the conversation is between Avalokiteshvara, the exposition is between Avalokiteshvara and Shariputra.
Yeah. So Avalokiteshvara is really teaching the sutra.
They're sort of in the presence of the Buddha.
Right, Buddha. Yeah, yeah. Buddha's kind of watching the conversation and spurring them on.
So compassion is actually teaching emptiness. Shariputra could represent analytical.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Like
yeah.
So compassion is actually preaching to her, teaching wisdom.
Isn't that interesting that, you know, because we have Manjushri's the perfect wisdom bodhisattva. So they're sort of a pair, Manjushri and Avalokiteshvara. So we might think, well, wouldn't it be more appropriate for Manjushri to teach the Heart Sutra on the wisdom of emptiness? But in fact, Avalokiteshvara does. So I think that's quite beautiful, that union of compassion and emptiness. And that the whole point of teaching the wisdom of emptiness is for the complete release of unhindered compassion. Actually, the point of it all in the end, and maybe that sutra just reminds us just by knowing it's taught by her. Also, the image of the hand and eye, we could also see as that's like the union of wisdom and compassion. Mm-hmm. Right? The eye sees reality as it is, and the hand helps, comes forth to aid beings. So the eye in the hand, 1,000 of them, a wonderful image, wisdom and compassion functioning together.
Interesting, the connection between that and the Christianity, the stigma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wonder about this.
Poking an eye.
Hmm?
Poking an eye.
Yeah. In a certain sense, like the stigma is kind of
mm-hmm.
eye.
Yeah.
Opening,
Yeah. In these pictures it's kind of appendix to this Daihi Shindarani Sutra. It has the pictures of the 42 hands, each one with an eye, each one holding, you know, like holding a dharma wheel, holding a staff, holding different tools to help in different ways. And one of them is like the eye in the hand is like this waterfall coming out of the eye. And it's like the sweet dew, amrita, nectar. Sometimes in China, Avalokiteshvara's got the vase pouring out this healing nectar to benefit beings. But this was a really potent image, I thought, of just like this spurt out of the eye in the hand of like healing ambrosia. Wow. These, you know, Mahayana founders were like very creative, had very creative minds, I think, to come up with this imagery. You don't find this like in early Buddhism, right? The Pali Canon, very straightforward. Here's just like steps to practice like this. But that's one of the trademarks of the Mahayana, is things get very cosmic. These Mahayana sutras, it's very creative imagery representing these different qualities of Buddha.
The tradition of shaking the hand, or also just holding your hand up like this, an open hand, is actually showing to the person you meet that you have no, you bear them no ill will, or you have no weapons. You're empty-handed, basically. So you come to meet someone
open-handed,
with open-handed or empty-handed.
Nice. Yeah. Extending an open hand, ready to help. Yeah, even though sometimes they have implements that maybe can, tools to use in various ways. Most of the 1,000 hands in that image are just empty hands. Like, well, yeah, when we meet, we'll see what's needed. We don't have any pre-planning here. And this is part of what's going to come out in this essay, is how compassion really functions, is with no preconceived notions. So another classic sutra of Avalokiteshvara is the Lotus Sutra, very important to Dogen. And there's a chapter devoted to Avalokiteshvara, chapter 25, the universal gateway of the Bodhisattva, regarder of the cries of the world. And it just begins with another bodhisattva named Inexhaustible Mind, who got up and put his palms together, eye to eye, hand to hand, facing the Buddha and said, "World Honored One, for what reason does the bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara have the name regarder of the cries of the world, the regarder of the world sounds? Why does he have that name?" So this is a nice explanation of the name. The Buddha answered, "Good child, if there were countless hundreds of thousands of billions of living beings experiencing suffering and agony who heard of this regarder of the cries of the world, Bodhisattva, and wholeheartedly called her name, regarder of the cries of the world, Bodhisattva would immediately hear their cries and all of them would be freed." Which is kind of interesting too, that it's like just by her hearing they're freed before she even brings out her like special dharma wheels and implements. Just when she hears, I think that was a little bit maybe like that Sharangama Sutra section too. When she hears completely, beings are relieved, because we want to be heard, right? We want, like, our suffering is that we feel like we're alone and no one understands and hears us. So we just have this sense that this great bodhisattva who has no location, is just can be here everywhere, is actually with us in sympathy and hearing our cries. We are free already. And then the sutra goes on to list these 33 different forms, and Dogen will mention That's the kind of classic 33 forms of Avalokiteshvara. She can take, she's not limited to like male or female or human or non-human. Great compassion can take any form to benefit beings with skillful means, because beings are benefited in different ways. So you can read that chapter 25 of the Lotus Sutra sometime if you like, but it goes through the 33 forms for, you know, for those, it even talks about like those who don't want to be bodhisattvas, who just want to be shravakas, she'll manifest as a shravaka. For those, you know, working in various occupations, she manifests as one of the co-workers. So there's these 33 classic forms that are actually, looking into this, appear in various sutras. So I think the different Mahayana sutras were influencing each other. And like the monastery I practiced in Japan had this path through the woods, and it was like the Kanon Sama walk, and it had 33 like these stone guanyins with different tools and representing these different 33 aspects. Of course, there's infinite, but the sutra is just these 33. And so, you know, every like 100 feet or so, you on the path through the woods, you come upon another stone guanyin. Very old, they were all covered with moss. Kind of like back here behind Jikoji, right? You have Jizo Bodhisattva and some other little shrines that you can meet these bodhisattvas in the woods. So, one more sutra. The Avatamsaka Sutra, the great flower ornament sutra, huge volume, where this is one chapter where a young man named Sudana goes on this pilgrimage to visit bodhisattvas, as many bodhisattvas as he can, to like learn all these different ways of bodhisattvas, and it goes on for hundreds and hundreds of pages, just that chapter. And like this picture and this image here, I think that the kind of the boy on the right side with his palms together, kind of like paying homage to Avalokiteshvara, I think that's Sudana. Like in China, often you see there's a boy and a girl both kind of bowing to Guanyin, and it's I've heard that it's Sudana from the Avatamsaka Sutra, and sometimes the girl is the Dragon King's daughter from the Lotus Sutra. Maybe just emphasizing that Avalokiteshvara is through all these different sutras and teachings. So Sudana made his way to Mount Potalaka, the Potala. Have you heard of the Potala Palace in Tibet, where the Dalai Lama sometimes said to be kind of living incarnation of Avalokiteshvara? So this palace is called Potala, which is the, in the sutras, the mountain home of Avalokiteshvara. And so there's the Potala in Tibet, and then in China there's Putoshan. Has anyone been to Putoshan? I went there one time. It's this island, small island off the coast of China, that's Guanyin's island. And Puto is the Putoshan, Puto Mountain. Puto is the Chinese way of saying Potala. So there's a Potala in Tibet, there's a Potala in China, and this island is just completely covered with Buddhist temples, kind of dedicated to Guanyin, and it's where she had supposedly lived. And there's like a kind of sort of underwater cave where she manifested. And so she's kind of associated with the ocean and water and the island. And in China, you often see images of her standing on a fish, or sometimes on a dragon in the water, and she's kind of riding, standing on the back of this dragon going through the water. So Sudana in the sutra made his way to Mount Potala, So I think in India there's also a place, Potala. Of course, every country wants to claim the homeland of Avalokiteshvara, so in America we'll eventually have a Mount Potala. Climbing the mountain, he looked around for Avalokiteshvara and saw him or her on a plateau on the west side of the mountain, adorned with springs, ponds, and streams, sitting wakefully on a diamond boulder. In the woods, surrounded by a group of bodhisattvas to whom he was teaching a doctrine called Light of Great Love and Compassion, which concerns the salvation of all living beings. So then they have these conversations. Avalokiteshvara says to Sudana, the pilgrim, as all these bodhisattvas have these conversations with him, and she says, "It's good that you aspire to supreme perfect awakening. I know of a way of awakening practice called undertaking great compassion without delay, which sets about impartially guiding all living beings to perfection, dedicated to protecting and guiding living beings by communicating wisdom to them through all media. Established in this method of awakening practice, undertaking great compassion without delay, I appear in the midst of the activities of all living beings without leaving the presence of all Buddhas, and take care of them by means of generosity, kind speech, beneficial action, and cooperation." These four bodhisattva methods, which Dogen teaches also, and we're going to have a class in Santa Cruz on in a few weeks or sometime later this summer. So I think that's a nice sutra source for Dogen's four methods for bodhisattvas: generosity, kind speech, beneficial action, and identity action or cooperation. That's what I teach, Avalokiteshvara says. And then she says, "Perfecting this practice of unhesitating compassion, I have vowed to be a refuge for all sentient beings, to free them from fears of calamity, threat, confusion, bondage, attacks on their lives, insufficiency of means to support life, inability to make a living, ill repute, the perils of life, intimidation by crowds, death, miserable conditions, unknown hardships, servitude, separation from loved ones, living with the uncongenial, physical violence, mental violence, sorrow, and depression. I've taken a vow to be a refuge for all beings from all these fears and perils." So beautiful. "And I've caused my name to be known in all worlds to drive away the fears of all beings." So, it's much longer, of course, but that's some of the great aspirations of this compassionate bodhisattva. And, she's depicted as these multi-armed forms and these different images, and we can make offerings of incense to her and so on. But I think with all these archetypal bodhisattvas, I think this is the great beauty of Mahayana Buddhism in particular, is they're really ourselves. The aspects we have, this compassionate nature, or an aspect of our true nature, is this unhindered compassion. And it's just like, it's hard to be able to stand that sometimes, or to like, it's too exalted, it's too great, we can't be like that. But the teaching is like that our Buddha nature actually is like that. It's just that it's dusty, it's clouded over, it's obscured by our habitual tendencies and views. So to kind of project her as a kind of external being, it maybe makes it easier to relate to this boundless compassion. But I think it's a skillful means to open to it, like our own great compassion. It's like this encouragement And when we call on her and she comes and relieves us, I think these are the questions I have. It's like, was there somebody actually out there that's coming and relieving us? That'd be kind of like a theistic religious view, yeah. So I think it's more subtle than that. It's not really that she's out there apart from us, but it's not really like, well, I, the way I think I am Avalokiteshvara. It's something like this, you know, mystical communion between Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and sentient beings. Kano Doko Dogen, let's say. The little being I think I am, meeting the great, compassionate, awakened one, which is like our own true nature. You know, our small self meeting our big self. In that meeting, this compassion could be revealed. So that's a little like introduction to Avalokiteshvara herself. Yeah, it seems one source I thought this was interesting, just historically. It was around sometime between the years 700 and 1000 is when she had this sex change. So for about 1,000 years, from about like 0 to 1000, she manifested this male form. And then somewhere around near 1000 to 2000, in East Asia particularly, he became like a female form, kind of historically speaking, due to causes and conditions and the evolution of humanity. So Avalokiteshvara, and then the story that Dogen's going to comment on. Basically, Dogen's whole essay is on this one, you know, pulling apart and exploring this one story of some Chinese Zen ancestors named Yunyan and Daowu. And Yunyan is in our lineage of Soto Zen. So he's our, like, you know, personal Dharma descendant. In Japanese we say Ungan Donjo Daiyosho. He's the teacher of Dungshan, the great Dungshan or Tozan Ryokai, who is like, you know, Tozan is the toe of Soto Zen. So in a way, we could say Yunyan is like the sort of grandfather of Soto Zen in China around the year around 700, around the time Avalokiteshvara was manifesting her female form. So Yunyan practiced with Yaoshan. His teacher was Yaoshan, Medicine Mountain. Yaoshan. Yunyan means cloudy cliff. And his brother Daowu, his Dharma brother, Yunyan's Dharma brother Daowu, which means like the way of self, literally. So there's many stories about Yunyan and Daowu because they were like really good Dharma friends. Daowu was like about 11 years older, sort of older Dharma brother. So sometimes they say, well, how would you say it, elder brother? Dharma brothers meaning they both practiced together, I think, under Baijiang, and then later under Yaoshan. Yaoshan's one of our Soto ancestors, and Baijiang is, or Hyakujo, is one of the great progenitors of Rinzai Zen. So, this is the golden age of Zen in China now, right, where there, people are going to visit all these different Zen teachers around the country and trying to clarify their understanding in this weird way of talking that became the style of the Zen tradition through these interesting dialogues that are very different from the sutras. So a little background about Yunyan before we go into the story. He's a great ancestor of ours, lived 780 to 840. And he practiced with Baijan. Bakujo is the one who had some dealings with the wild fox. You might know that story, Zen story. Hyakujo is also kind of like honored as the one who first set up the kind of Zen monastery forms in China. It was still the early days of Zen. So Yunyan practiced with Baijan for 20 years, and then Baijan died. And he never quite fully realized the way. I think he understood many things and practiced diligently, I think, with Baijan, but it seemed like there was something he hadn't quite fully settled into with Baijan. So the old record says he studied under Baijan for 20 years but did not meet with the source. Didn't realize his complete free-flowing, full awakening. Later, he went to practice with Yaoshan, who he would later become a Dharma descendant of Yaoshan. Yaoshan asked him, where have you come from? As they often ask, where are you coming from? Yunyan said, from Baijan. And Yaoshan said, well, what did Baijan say to his disciples? Yunyan said, he had the saying, the 100 tastes are complete. That was one thing he often said. All the 100 flavors are complete. Yaoshan said, well, something salty tastes salty, and something sweet tastes sweet. What's neither salty nor sweet is just like a normal taste. So what's meant by this phrase, 100 tastes are complete? And Yunyan could not answer. That's the way these Zen people talked in the old days. Yaoshan, so this is a picture of the scene. Maybe it's when Yunyan first came to practice with Yaoshan and they're having this first kind of discussion. So Yaoshan, kind of interestingly, he doesn't ask about Yunyan's own understanding. He said, what did your teacher teach? Mm-hmm. And he keeps asking, what did your teacher, Baijan, say about the birth and death before our eyes? And Yunyan said, oh, he actually said that there is no birth and death before our eyes. And Yaoshan said, how long were you at Baijan's place? Yunyan said, 20 years. Yaoshan said, you spent 20 years with Baijan, but you still haven't rid yourself of rustic ways. It says here, maybe kind of like too simple an understanding. In other words, to say that there is no birth and death in front of my eyes, that's too coarse and simple. So there's kind of sparring a little bit here. Right? Later, Yunyan was serving as Yaoshan's attendant, the Jisha. And Yaoshan kept pressing him, like, all the time. What else did Baijan say? He must have wanted... maybe he had heard about the great Baijan, who was one of the greatest Zen ancestors of this time. He's like, well, I never got to meet him, and his mountain's too far away. But, you know, I can hear about his teachings for years, since you've spent 20 years with him. So... he keeps asking Yaoshan about Baijan's teaching. What else did he say? Yunyan said, well, one time he came into the hall for a Dharma talk, and as soon as everybody sat down, he like stood up and took his staff and started like hitting everybody and chasing them out. And as they were running out of the room, he yelled, wait! And they all stopped and turned around, and he said, what is it? Actually, that story is in one of the cases in the Book of Serenity. As he's So picture the scene. Dharma talk like this. We just sit down. We do the opening chant. And maybe I get up and start going around. Everyone's like, "Dog, get out of here!" And Bhajan was kind of that kind of guy who would do that a lot. And as they were running, though, he's like, "Wait!" But they stopped, huh? And it turned around in just readiness, total, like, open readiness. It's like, we're in this really dramatic situation, right? You can picture their eyes are wide open. "Huh?" And he said, "What is it?" And we don't know how many people like had some kind of awakening at that moment. But now this is Yunyan recounting this story, right? He's saying, one time Baijiang did this, right? And he's telling it to his current teacher, Yaoshan. And Yaoshan this time says, instead of kind of insulting him, he says, "Why didn't you tell me this before? Thanks to you, today I've finally seen elder brother Baijiang." And upon hearing these words from Yaoshan, Yunyan, who had just told the story, realized great enlightenment. I love these stories. So if you didn't catch the full thing here. So Yunyan, who is our kind of like hero of this fascicle that we study, Yunyan is talking with his new teacher Yaoshan about his previous teacher Baijiang, right? He's telling these stories about when I practiced with Baijiang, this happened. So, well, what else did Baijiang teach? Well, one time he did this thing of like chasing everybody out and saying, "What is it?" And then Yaoshan, who's the one in the present conversation who he's recounting the story to, who keeps asking him, "What did Baijiang teach?" He says, "Why didn't you tell me this story before? Now I finally meeting Baijiang. Like, now I really understand who he was through this story." And when he says, "Now I really understand who your previous teacher was," Yunyan, the one talking with Yaoshan, has an awakening. You follow that? Mm-hmm. I think that's so cool that he told the story. He didn't have an awakening when he told the story, right? But when his teacher says, "Now I finally met him," then he has an awakening. So dynamic.
He authorized it, or
he maybe somehow pointed out like the amazing quality of that story of like, what is it?